net at will.uiuc.edu. It's 5 p.m. Keeping the Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith. Steve Shoemaker won't be able to make it this afternoon. He's under the weather, and I am Don Nolan. I'm substituting for Steve this afternoon. Welcome to the program. We have with us this afternoon one of our more distinguished religious leaders in Urbana-Champaign. He is the rector and chaplain of St. John's Episcopal Church on campus, Father Tim Hallett. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Our topic for today, among others, is a renovation and expansion program that's going on at St. John's. And I understand that it has a very interesting history, and we'll be discussing that in a few minutes. But before we do, let me just let you know that this is a call-in program. And if you have any questions for Father Hallett during this hour, feel free to call in at 333-9455. If you're living outside of the 217 area, you can call 1-800-222-9455. Well, why don't we just get started? Let's talk a little bit about your history at St. John's. When did you first arrive at St. John's?
We got here in 1976 and have been here ever since. We've had a wonderful experience with our congregation here. It's a great community to raise our children in, and whenever we've had feelers, we just decided, why would we want to do that instead?
That's quite a long tenure.
Yes.
It's got to be among the longer tenures, I would imagine, around the country.
Well, I think so. I think there's certainly nobody who is as long in the tooth in campus ministry as I am.
On campus or otherwise, right?
Right. Yeah.
Where had you come from before?
Well, I had briefly been in a parish in the suburbs of Chicago. Prior to that, I was doing graduate work at the University of Chicago and had been in campus ministry in Minnesota at Mankato State University once I'd gotten out of seminary. So really most of my career has been spent in campus ministry.
Where did you go to seminary and college?
I went to college at the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee, and then to seminary at Seabury Western up in Evanston.
Mm-hmm. Are you a Southerner?
No, I was a Minnesota boy and thought it would be interesting to have a cross-cultural experience.
Mm-hmm. What years were you in seminary? Probably 60s?
I was in seminary from 62 to 65.
Mm-hmm. Exciting time to be in the seminary.
They were preparing you for a church that didn't exist by the time you left seminary.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, at that time, seminary educations were fairly set in their ways, fairly set in their patterns. In our church, it was a semi-monastic environment and not attuned to the cultural upheavals that were taking place at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We had to learn that on our own.
Lots of change.
Yep.
And then you came here in 1976. How large was the congregation then, and what is it now?
Well, I think the congregational size has remained fairly stable, probably around 225 to 250 baptized members. We minister to more people than that, but that's about what we've got on our books.
Mm-hmm.
Given the kind of turnover that takes place in a campus community, stability itself is not bad.
Mm-hmm. How do you fit in? How does St. John's fit into the overall organizational structure of the American Episcopal Church? As I understand it, there's an Anglican communion, and there are various different levels of organizational structure.
Correct. We are a parish of the Diocese of Springfield, which is geographically about the lower two-thirds of Illinois. There are three dioceses in Illinois, Chicago, Quincy, and Springfield, but we're structurally part of the Diocese of Springfield.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, the term Episcopal is a uniquely American term, deriving from changes in the history of the Anglican Communion as it evolved from the Church of England.
That's correct. After the American Revolution, it didn't seem like a very good idea to continue to call the church here the Church of England. And Anglican simply means English, just a Latin nomenclature for English. So they borrowed the term from the Scottish Episcopal Church. Episcopos is a Greek word meaning bishop or overseer. So we're the church with bishops.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that, I believe it was June, that the American Episcopal Church nominated its, and now has installed, its first presiding bishop. Is that right? And she's a female.
That's correct. She is not the first presiding bishop, but she's the first
female,
the first female presiding bishop in this church or in any other Anglican church.
Shorey, I believe.
Yes, Catherine Jeffords Shorey.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a remarkable historical moment in the history of the American church in general. Not
well,
just
yes,
the Episcopal church.
In fact, in the worldwide church. she is the first woman bishop to be the head of a national denomination.
Mm-hmm. And there are worldwide 70 plus million in the communion, which includes
us and churches throughout the world.
And what is the number one bishop in the Archbishop in Canterbury? That is his title?
Right. The Archbishop of Canterbury is the kind of first among equals of the Anglican bishops. Canterbury is regarded as a sort of mother church of the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
The Archbishop of Canterbury's position is prestigious, but it is not comparable to the papacy.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have direct authority over other Episcopal churches or Anglican churches.
Well, let's come back to Urbana, one of the more beautiful structures in this town is St. John's, and you have been a major part of its history, and as I understand it, you are now about to bear fruit from a long fundraising campaign to expand and improve the nave and other aspects of the church. Could you describe a little bit about what that's about?
Well, anyone who has ever walked around the campus past the corner of Wright and Armory Street has seen from the front a beautiful Gothic chapel with three bays of Gothic splendor behind it, and then a temporary completion that we affectionately refer to as the lean-to. The lean-to was built in 1927 when, having completed the first portion of the chapel, they ran out of funds. In those days, of course, they thought, well, we'll just continue in a few years. They weren't counting on the stock market crash and the Depression and world wars. So, as someone once said, it looks like the stock market crashed right on that church.
Hmm.
So we've been waiting ever since. In the 60s, there was an attempt to complete the chapel, but they were only able to raise sufficient funds to build Canterbury House, which is our center next door to the chapel. And the completion stood in abeyance for another 40 years.
Mm-hmm. And how long has the fundraising been going on?
Well, we've received gifts and bequests over the years, and those had accumulated to around $800,000. A couple of years ago, we began both architectural studies and a feasibility study for a capital campaign. And we've been going at it ever since. The campaign has been very successful, although it remains open. We were able to raise much in excess of what our consultants thought we would be able to do, which is a testimony to the commitment of our congregation and to the affection of those who were part of this congregation during their student years.
What's the price tag on the overall project?
The project cost is about $2.5 million.
Mm-hmm. And it's been going. What's the time frame for the overall
project?
We
hope to be in by midsummer. That's the construction schedule.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice for us to have the rededication in October, which is when the first services on the campus of the university were held in 1910.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping to be able to dedicate it in October.
The first services were 1910.
Yes, and the history of the ministry goes back until 1901. The first references
on the U of I campus.
The first references to a group of people coming together to address the needs of campus ministry is in 1901. In 1905, they secured some property, a house, and it was a residence for young women called Osborne Hall. There were about 30 young women living there under the tutelage of a matron, and that house continued until World War II, when it was converted into a hospital. They then bought some other space and have had centers at a couple of places since. The property where we stand now was acquired in the mid-20s, and construction begun in 1925.
Mm-hmm. What's the oldest Episcopal congregation in Champaign County? Do you know?
Emmanuel.
Is it Emmanuel?
Emmanuel Memorial Episcopal Church downtown.
When did they establish?
I can't tell you the exact date, but they go well before the turn of the century, and they were a well-established congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, members of Emmanuel were instrumental in the early stages of the ministry on campus.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, the fundraising effort apparently has been quite remarkable over how many years?
Well, the active phase of it has just been over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. But over a number of years, people have, alumni in particular, have made contributions with the intent of this being...
Yes, it's always been a dream. People who have been a part of the chapel's life love the place. They love it physically. They love its ministry. It's been a formative place for so many that they are anxious to see it completed, and many of the alumni have responded very generously.
What's it going to look like?
It will be compatible with what has gone before, but a bit larger. In Gothic architecture, a bay represents one of the large window units, that entire space from ground to roof. We have three bays now. They're 60 feet high each. We'll have another bay at 60 feet. And then the chancel will drop a bit and extend. The footpad of the building will be somewhat larger than it currently is, and it will give us an additional 50 spaces of seating. It will have accessibility features. But it will look like it should. Our architects have been Isaacson Glerum Wachter. Mm. And any of you who have seen the Urbana Library know what a nice job they did in making a contemporary building compatible with an existing one. And for that reason, we decided they'd be good architects for us as well.
Lots of stonework.
Yes, lots of stonework. We've been talking to the construction people, and the masons are really looking forward to the chance to work in limestone, which is not something they normally get to do.
It's a almost forgotten art in many places.
Right. The contractors are English brothers, and English brothers were also the original contractors. So,
oh, is that right?
So,
in 1927?
Right.
Uh-huh.
So they're happy to be.
Did they keep the blueprints?
Well, we have some in the archives, and we're able to make part of that available at least to the architects as they made the plans.
Mm-hmm.
But English Brothers is very pleased to be able to finish what they started.
I see. Very interesting. Any I suppose it's the 27's awful long way back. I don't imagine that anybody has a memory.
No, but they've been uncovering foundational work and so forth as we prepare for the new structure. And the workmen say, gosh, those guys did a good job. Look at that.
Ah, so they're impressed with themselves.
Right, they're impressed with their forebears.
You might describe a little bit the Catholic, Anglican, Episcopal design. It's a design that is essentially European in origin, and many in the Protestant tradition may not be acquainted with it.
Right, in a typical Gothic building, there will be the nave, which is where the congregation sits. It comes from a Greek word, naos, for the ship, the place where the folks are. And then where the choir and altar area combined would be called the chancel. Sometimes we would talk about the nave, the choir, and the sanctuary, but in our nomenclature, the sanctuary is only the part that is the altar area rather than the entire building itself. So we'll have an expanded nave. The chancel will be about the same size, and the footpad of everything a bit larger.
Mm-hmm. And you say there'll be about 50 more seats?
Yes.
Wider or longer?
Longer.
Mm-hmm.
We're one of those places that tends to fill up beyond the 80% capacity, which is the comfort level in churches.
It's not a lot of pews there.
So we hope that that the larger space will make us more inviting and perhaps increase the congregational size as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it will certainly make us more available to community events. There are various musical groups who enjoy performing there. We have a magnificent pipe organ. Many of the
Beaux-Arts, isn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Many of the university organ students practice and do their recitals on our instrument. The university choir did a magnificent performance of the Durufle Requiem last year. More space will make us more available for that kind of mm-hmm. event as well. And then we'll have the accessibility features that that will make it more attractive for people to be able to come.
So what are you moving? You're moving the porch or the...
Well, we're moving the altar. It'll be the altar area that we'll be moving west.
Okay,
west
so you're
grids.
Going to have to do something with the organ as well, yes?
No, the organ is at the east end.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And the organ...
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
The organ at the moment is in a huge baggie. But it will be removed as the construction proceeds.
Oh,
and
you will have
installed.
To remove the
yes.
organ. Ah, mm-hmm. this is a big project.
Right.
My goodness. Well, do you have any other plans down the road besides this as far as enlarging? I know you have the Canterbury House, which you might want to describe a little bit about.
Well, it's a It's a building with a parish hall, a student center. There's some residential component to it. That's our programmatic space, save for worship. It would be nice to connect those, and we have a concept for connecting the chapel and Canterbury House, but we're not going to attempt that at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Very different architectural exteriors, so we'll be a little careful with that, I would imagine.
Right. We'll we'll let that happen a little later.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is – would it be fair to say that you're – that St. John's is primarily a campus ministry, or predominantly, or what?
We call ourselves a campus-based parish ministry. And I'd generally divide us equally among students, faculty, staff, and townspeople, about 25% of each.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And I understand students have been pretty active in attempting to renovate the porch area.
Well, In the original campaign, there hadn't been much response. This is back in the 20s. There hadn't been much response to efforts to get fundraising going. The ministry was in existence for, 20, 25 years before the chapel
right.
itself was built. So there was a go-getter student who energized other students, and they began to make personal commitments. So that the porch could be built. They went down to Bedford, Indiana, where the limestone came from, and talked the president of Consolidated Stone Company into donating the limestone for the porch. That kind of jump-started the efforts. The adult Episcopalians of Illinois were shamed into action by the students. And so in fairly short order, they were able to raise the funds for what was built in 1925.
Mm-hmm. If any of our listeners have not had a chance to walk through that portal, it is really a remarkable piece of architecture.
We keep it open during the day and into the evening do that very intentionally. It's remarkable the number of people who've mentioned to me, well, I can't wait till the chapel is finished because I like to stop in there and say my prayers or just sort of have some quiet time. A lot of people who aren't an immediate part of our congregation do enjoy that space as a place for meditation and reflection.
Mm-hmm. Just to remind our listeners, you're perfectly welcome to call in if you have any questions for our guest this afternoon. Our number here is 333-9455. If you're out of the 217 area, you can call 1-800-222-9455. And we are speaking with the rector and chaplain of St. John's Episcopal Church on the University of Illinois campus. And our topic this afternoon is the expansion and development of a long-term project resulting in an enlargement of the main body of the church. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question?
Yes, hello. Last week I heard St. John praise for the organ, and how long will the organ be not able to be played? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Well, the construction schedule calls for completion in mid-July. If we meet that date, I figure that the organ will be up and running, if not right away, in very short order. So by the time we begin the programmatic year in 2007, in the fall, we should be up and running at full speed.
When was that organ originally installed?
That was built in 1991.
Mm-hmm. John Paul Buzard.
Right. And when we installed the organ, it was intentionally designed with a completed building in mind. So it's larger than it needed to be for what we had. Mm. But we'll take care of the sound needs in the increased space with little problem. We should have an enhanced acoustic as well, so that that things will sound even more magnificent in there.
Are you putting in?
Well, there's larger space, and we're taking pains to make sure that that the acoustics are preserved and enhanced.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing any sound enhancement other than just the enlargement?
We'll have sound enhancement for the spoken word, but but that's all.
That organ is got to be one of the most remarkable ones here in Champaign. How many are there here now?
Well, there are a number of distinguished pipe organs in.
Talking about the Buzard. Organs.
I can't tell you offhand how many Buzards there are in town. I know that that the Baptist Church in Savoy has one. We have one. There are a number in the area. St. James United Methodist Church in Danville has one. There are quite a number of them in Chicago. There are increasingly a number of them in Indianapolis. They're on both coasts. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate to have that instrument.
It's a shame we're going to go through the Christmas season without.
Yes, at present we're worshiping in the basement of Canterbury House, and we have created what we think is a much more attractive and functional worship space than we had thought we'd be able to do. But we have a little tiny pipe organ down there, and are kind of making do as the completed chapel rises next door.
Well, I must say, I've heard of many organizations and institutions doing strategic planning for 5 years, 10 years, but I don't think I've heard of one for 80 years. That's a long-term sustained
right.
vision.
Well, the mills of God grind slowly.
There you go. Why don't you describe a little bit about Canterbury House? What's its mission?
Well, Canterbury House, as I said, functions as our parish center. So, in its normal configuration, we have kitchen, choir room, church school facilities, lounges, all of the kinds of things that a typical parish house has. And we have on the top floor two apartments, and there are seven rooms in those apartments that are occupied by students.
Oh, so students do live there.
Right.
It's a partial dormitory.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is there any long-term plans to expand that, or is that pretty much where it's going to be?
Well, I think we'll get the chapel paid off first.
Mm-hmm.
But Canterbury House is serving us well in the interim, we're cramped and using various mm-hmm. things in a variety of ways. But it's bearing up.
What who is the campus minister?
Well, we have a couple of students who we call peer ministers, and they help out programmatically, but I'm the only mm-hmm. full-time ordained staff member.
Mm-hmm.
We have an organist choir master, Linda Buzard, and wonderful choral programs under her direction, and we have a full-time secretary, Justine Shepline, who is one of the jewels in our crown as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Justine is a jewel in a lot of crowns in town. I understand that. How old is the Canterbury House?
Canterbury House is built in 1967, and that was after the tenure of Frederick Arvidsson, one of my predecessors, who had been here for 20 years. And so he was instrumental in the design and fundraising for Canterbury House.
Mm-hmm. And it's among the more remarkable. It's among the remarkable array of ministries here on this campus.
Yes.
Don't have a full knowledge of all of them. I just have a knowledge of a few. And apparently, they have a long and distinguished history.
Right. We believe that this was the first Episcopal Church built to serve the needs of a state university community.
In Illinois, the United States.
In the United States. Mm-hmm. It was part of a movement across the country at that time as people began to recognize.
We're talking the 1925, 1927.
From the turn of the century on, mm-hmm. People began to realize that state university campuses needed to have religious communities ministering to the students and faculty and staff.
Mm-hmm.
So we believe we're the first Episcopal Church. I'm quite certain that the Wesley Foundation is the first of the Methodist churches built mm-hmm. as a foundation on a university campus. The McKinley Foundation, the Presbyterians, is among the first. Newman Center is among the first large Newman Centers. So there's a long history, and almost all of the mainline churches have a long history on this campus and continue to flourish. Alas, this is not always the case on other campuses, but mm-hmm. But here there is a long and distinguished tradition of campus ministry.
Mm-hmm. Membership in these campus ministries, you say, has been pretty stable here at the University of Illinois, but across the country there's been a pretty significant decline over the past two decades. Isn't that correct?
Right. In the Episcopal Church, many of the campus ministries have tended to be freestanding operations with a chaplain, perhaps a student center with a small chapel, but no parish component. And when a diocese becomes strapped for money, it's easy to say, well, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to fund the campus ministry.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pattern that has happened not only in the Episcopal Church, but
so many have disappeared.
But throughout the mainline churches, there's been a real gutting of campus ministries, which is very unfortunate.
Across the country?
Yes.
And public institutions, mostly?
Yes. Usually in private institutions, the chaplaincy is established in some kind of way, although there have been colleges that were church-related that have terminated their chaplains as well.
What accounts for that, do you think, that decline?
Well, I think part of it is the direction that higher education has taken in the last half century or so, an increasingly secularized approach and an assumption that perhaps religion and the intellectual life are not compatible. I don't think that's the case, but I think that's a widely held assumption.
Today.
And most of the mainline traditions have what you could call a liberal and intellectual bent.
Certainly the Episcopalian Anglican tradition has always placed high value on scholarship.
Right, right. As has the Roman tradition, the Lutheran tradition, mm-hmm. the Reformed tradition. They all have the magnificent theological traditions and have been a major part of the synthesis of Western intellectual life. But I think that's simply not as recognized a part of the cultural fabric as it once was.
Well, you've certainly been in the thick of this for the past mm-hmm. 35, 40 years here at the University of Illinois, if not your entire career.
Right.
So you don't see a change? Many commentators talk about a new spirituality and new approaches to worship across the country, mainline traditions aren't benefiting from this at all?
Well, I think they are in many places. The Episcopal Church continues to attract people who are looking for an ability to exercise their minds in their faith, and who are looking for a beautiful liturgy, who are looking for an enlightened social atmosphere and social concern. This ministry has been the entry point for many people into the Episcopal Church, and of course its existence has been important in retaining many people who came to us and might have drifted away if it hadn't been here. That's the history of campus ministries everywhere. I was talking with some colleagues a couple of weeks ago, colleagues from other denominations, and we were talking about the pattern of abandonment of campus ministry in the mainline churches. And yet, whenever you go to a major church function, you'll run into people in leadership in the churches who would count their time in their campus ministry as crucial to their continued life in the church. Often they met their spouses there, and yet it's very easy to forget that when a diocese thinks it needs its money to go somewhere else.
You bring back some personal memories for me.
Right.
just to remind the listening audience, you can call in to talk with Father Hallett about any of these topics this afternoon. The number is 333-9455 outside of the 217 area. You can call 1-800-222-9455. What are students looking for these days in a campus ministry and in their religious experience, given what you just said earlier? What do campus ministries need to do to be more challenging? I hate to use the word relevant. Clearly, you have had a ministry that's been stable over the years, so I'm sure you feel gratified at that. But given these challenges, over and above creating a more beautiful atmosphere through this enlargement campaign, what else do we need to be doing?
I don't think there's any single approach that works with students and young adults, any single magic bullet or magic potion. I think there is a great variety of students as well as a great variety of other people, and that different people respond to different approaches. The parachurch groups are flourishing on our campuses.
Parachurch?
Right.
That term?
Groups such as InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
I see.
Campus Crusade for Christ and similar approaches, evangelical approaches often built predominantly around Bible study. Those are flourishing extremely important to many students. The Newman Foundation has a variety of programs targeted to the breadth of student population that's represented in the Roman Catholic Church. Each of the campus religious foundations has its kind of own flavor. Our flavor, I would call an energized traditional approach. We don't have a praise band. We don't we don't have what is often called contemporary music. Our musical approach
you mean,
is...
You mean rock music is not a part of your liturgy?
No. our music is very much a part of the classical Anglican musical tradition, which is a wonderful tradition. And if it is done with energy and integrity, is still, as it has been for centuries, a very moving way to worship and to deepen one's understanding and faith. I think that the religious foundations that succeed always manage to provide a strong sense of community for their members, a sense that there are people who really do care about them, and also a sense that if there are people who care about you, maybe you need to care about other people as mm-hmm. well. And so they have a significant commitment to social action and social concerns, either through the direct activity of their congregations or in impelling the various members of their congregations to do that.
What kind of programming does the Canterbury House offer along those lines?
We have for undergraduate students a weekly supper and a discussion. Our peer ministers often will take the lead in designing and implementing those programs, so that they will vary depending on the skills and talents of the peer ministers. I think most of our campus religious foundations do have students that are working closely with their programs and instrumental in implementing them.
Mm-hmm. Who are your peer ministers?
Well, we have two undergraduate students who have been peer ministers. Some of our former peer ministers have spread their wings and begun a group for young adults in the congregation, and so they continue to gather.
Something
they call it
society.
The Something Society mm-hmm. for 20, 30-something folks. So our congregation looks much like many others. We have everyone from infancy to old age, but a bulge in the young adult demographic, and mm-hmm. We're very pleased to have that bulge.
Now, there are Episcopalian congregations around the country that have liberalized the liturgy, haven't
yes,
they?
Yes, yes. And for some of them it works. I think, in general,
I'm not sure that's the best term. Liberalize the liturgy,
right? Made it more contemporary, mm-hmm. contemporary, and so forth. I think some of that depends on your regional dynamics. The places that seem to flourish with that tend to be in the
bigger cities.
Well, no, they tend to be in the southeast and southwest.
I see.
I'm not aware of many places in the north where that's a successful model for the Episcopal Church.
Hmm.
It seems that in this part of the country, at least, we do well to stick to what we're good at, but do it well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You got to do it well. But if you do it well, it works, and there are many thriving Episcopal congregations that have frisky but traditional worship and and
frisky
yes you know our liturgical style at St. John's when we're in the chapel, you know, we're kind of low church, you know, down in the basement, but in the chapel it's an elevated liturgical style, but it's mm-hmm. but it's not prissy, and it does have energy.
How do you describe that? I've sat through mm-hmm. Several over the years. It's high church, but with intensity, and how do you characterize that?
Well, I think sometimes a high church liturgy can become just too mannered, too balletic, too
formulaic.
Too formulaic, yes. So you have to do it right, but you don't want to be a twit while you're doing it, you know. I think that you certainly need good music. You need to take the liturgy seriously, but not take yourself seriously.
For a young undergraduate seeking to explore on this campus, what is there about the liturgy that should be taken seriously? I think you might find in many megachurches that liturgy is hardly recognizable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it has its own pattern and its own integrity. What the liturgy that you will find in an Episcopal church or Roman Catholic or Lutheran church is one that has evolved through the centuries, through centuries of Christian worship, and the pattern has remained constant through those centuries. So it provides a kind of continuity, a sense of groundedness with
historical richness,
with what has gone before, an almost physical linkage to the past. It doesn't mean that there's no development. It doesn't mean that it's frozen, but it certainly means that you are in contact with the church as it has lived its worship throughout the centuries.
Mm-hmm. The Episcopal and Anglican tradition has often thought of itself as mediary between Protestantism and Catholicism. Is that still fair to say?
Right. I mean, I think there's a sense in which if you ask one Episcopalian, are you Protestant or Catholic, you might say Protestant, ask another one, you'd say Catholic, and in some significant sense, they're both right. Mm-hmm. We're a Catholic church that has undergone a Reformation. And depending on who you are and where you are, you may tend towards the Protestant side of that spectrum or towards the Catholic side. But the genius has always been one of sticking together and encompassing as much of that wonderful sweep of Christian tradition as we possibly can.
And part of the rationale for this long-term commitment to expand on this project is to enhance that historical richness in the structure itself. Do you have hopes that this might be more appealing to students as they? My guess is that a lot of students and a lot of citizens in general in this country are going to probably rediscover the mainline tradition, precisely because it is, how did Martin Marty once described it, a moor in the ocean of spirituality that is grounded in some sense, and that appeal, I would guess, will grow.
Right. There's always some percentage of people who visit the Episcopal Church and discover that's home. They may have never known it before.
Why is that?
But
I've seen that several times. What is there about that?
I think it's more often than anything, it's the liturgy. But again, it has to be that liturgy done well and with integrity and with intensity. And that liturgy itself is a wonderful act of proclamation, a wonderful evangelical tool. And has deep appeal for many people, many people who have grown up with it, of course, but But for those who haven't experienced it, it's often, oh my gosh, this is where
this
I
am. This is for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sense of rootedness, I think many people find satisfying just in and of itself. If anyone's traveled at all throughout Europe or England and participated in some of the great old cathedrals, the sense of history and meaning and symbolism is so palpable. In this country, that's often a lost tradition, and when people encounter it that they've never encountered it before, it seems to be catalyzing for
right.
them spiritually.
Right. We've often had people who've been studying abroad come back and say, well, you know, I went to the Anglican Church in such and such while I was studying there, and I really liked it, and how do I join up?
Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to, what is the opening date, the ribbon cutting date, or whatever it is
well,
you're going to do?
We hope that we'll be up and running at full speed by fall of 2007.
Is there going to be a day when you commemorate?
We'll have a multiplicity of dedicatory events, and we'll want to publicize those as much as we can and invite as many people as we can to be part of it. We're not just building this for ourselves. We see it as a resource for the community. It'll certainly be a lot nicer to look at than the lean-to. It'll be another beautiful but complete structure in the midst of the campus, and we hope that it can be used by the community for a variety of purposes as well as for our own needs.
Are you going to do much decorative work on the inside? I've often noted there's a certain sparseness.
Yes, and the... It won't look that much different inside than it did before it was completed. The non-completion was more graceful inside than it was outside. So that look won't change, and the austerity of the altar area is deliberate. It's so that the attention is drawn directly to the altar. And particularly when we are involved in the celebration of the Eucharist, so that there isn't a lot that is going to distract you from that action that is taking place at the altar. The altar is generally vested. The people who are at the altar are vested. The colors change seasonally. The action is around the altar, liturgical action of various sorts. And the focus is deliberately riveted there.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. That was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I was once in a mass at Cathedral of Reims, and I couldn't concentrate on it.
Right. Well, there's so much. I mean, it's nice if the sermon is boring to be able to, you know, look at some mm-hmm. pretty windows or whatever, but. But particularly during the celebration of the Eucharist, attention should be focused on what's happening at the altar.
To focus on the ritual there,
right?
There's also an inner component to this as well, right?
Right. The prayer, the prayer of consecration of the Eucharistic prayer, is called the Great Thanksgiving. And as we celebrate the Holy Communion, there is a rehearsal of God's mighty acts generation to generation, culminating in the Incarnation, the cross and passion, the resurrection, and that whole salvation history is rehearsed in the course of that prayer, and the Jesus' own words of institution are used. So we want people to have their minds on that as much as they can, and their visual focus, their ceremonial focus, their spiritual focus.
Are you going to place where the organ where it is now?
Yes, the organ will stay in its present position. We won't need much new furniture except for a few more chairs.
Now, you don't have a date certain in the fall when this is
No, we're toying with dedication dates, but we can't set them quite this soon.
I would imagine there are many distinguished alumni over the years, my goodness, all the way back to 1910, that, not all the way back to 1910, there may be some still alive, that you may wish to communicate this to. Are you out there spreading the word?
And in the Capitol campaign, I visited a great many of our alumni from people who had graduated here from the 50s onwards, and many of them are quite distinguished folks.
Who are some of the more famous ones?
Well, the president of USC is one of ours.
The current president?
The current president of USC.
Don't have much to say about him. He just beat Notre Dame.
Right. The Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford is one. And another fellow and chaplain at Oxford is another. A great many clergy. There were four of our alumni who were deputies at the recent General Convention in Columbus
summer.
Of the Episcopal Church, yes. So there's a lot of leadership that has emanated from it. The traveling around really made me believe the campus ministry propaganda about how important this ministry is. It was just an overwhelming sense of affirmation of the importance of campus ministry, and I've shared that with as many of my colleagues and of all denominations as I possibly can.
Are you going to invite in the bishop?
Well, the bishop will certainly be here for our dedication, our own bishop. I doubt that we would be able to get on the presiding bishop's calendar, but our own bishop.
No, I was just getting ready to ask. you don't think that's a
I don't think that's
likelihood?
That's not a likelihood, no.
So we should anticipate October, September, October?
October, all during the fall. I'm sure we're going to be having a series of events to throw open the doors and welcome people in.
I hope you get a chance to invite one of my favorite, Bishop Spong.
He's retired now.
Yes, but he's still certainly writing a few incendiary books out there.
He's still writing.
So you're going to be doing more and more traveling, or have you done most of it?
No, I've done most of the traveling now, and it's time to get back to work here.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Father Hallett. We've been talking to the rector and chaplain of St. John's Episcopal Church. They're undergoing a major renovation of that church, and in the fall, we hope to see the results. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is Don Nolan. Thank you for listening on Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
How did the universe begin? Science says it all started with the Big Bang. Religion sees the mysterious hand of God. Is there room in the cosmos for both? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll explore the issue in part two of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Monday morning on Focus 580 at 11, the topic will be women's health. Dr. Suzanne Truppen will be here to take your questions. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist who teaches at the U of I College of Medicine. Every other month, always on a Monday, she stops by to take calls and talk about recent developments in her field. In past conversations, we've covered a wide range of subjects, everything from family planning and pregnancy to birthing and breastfeeding to menopause and osteoporosis. I'm David Inge, the host. It's Focus 580, Monday at 11, here on WILL Urbana.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a chance of light rain, the low in the upper 40s with south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high